Say it loud, people.
Welcome to Metropolis Rising. I'm your host, Nicholas DeGenova, cultural anthropologist, political geographer, and social critic. We're led to believe that culture is produced by celebrities, or that it's something that should be guarded in museums, that history is the story of powerful men, and that politics is only about the ambitions of those who want to dominate the government. But those stale ideas get shattered when we give our personal struggles the prominence they deserve, when culture is what we create in everyday life, when those struggles of everyday people are the real stuff of making history, and when politics becomes a radically open-ended imagination of changing how we actually live. That's how the metropolis rises. In this episode of Metropolis Rising, my guest is Martin Sorondegui, also known as Martin Crudo. Martin is a Latinx artist, best known as the founder, lead singer, and lyricist of the Latinx hardcore punk band Los Crudos. The band originated in the 1990s in Chicago's Pilsen neighborhood, where Martin grew up. For decades, Pilsen was the center of the political and cultural life of Chicago's Mexican community and fostered a vibrant Latinx art scene, despite its notoriety as an impoverished barrio plagued by gang violence. The lyrics of the band's songs were almost exclusively in Spanish and spoke politically to the Latinx experience in the United States, but also responded to popular struggles across Latin America. Los Crudos quickly came to have an impact across the United States and indeed around the world. Later, Sorondegui moved on to other musical projects, including the queercore punk band Limp Wrist, and most recently, a solo electronic dance music project called Nerve. The interrogation of masculinity and sexuality has been a resounding theme in Martin's music. Beyond his music, Martin curated and exhibited the memorabilia and ephemera of the Latinx punk scene. Martin is also an accomplished photographer. Although he grew up in Chicago's Mexican community, Martin's family is originally from Uruguay, where he was born before his family fled dictatorship and political repression.
Con la milonga la voy de igual a igual, porque también soy milonga. Vengo de un barrio sencillo y querendón.
I was born in Montevideo, Uruguay. I was there, maybe 2 years old when my family migrated here to Chicago. And we ended up in the Pilsen community. It was a real interesting time, I think, in Uruguay. It was 1968. It was right, we left right before the golpe de Estado happened. And what basically ensued was a military dictatorship shortly after we left.
El Consejo de Estado tendrá como cometido fundamental el de proyectar las reformas necesarias de la Constitución de la República y que serán, en definitiva, sometidas a plebiscito que exprese el juicio.
Were your parents political?
My dad was not. My mom was. My mom studied medicine in Montevideo. Her friends used to call her Pati la Socialista, and she definitely was much more progressive. And it was like she had a lot of ideas, she had a lot of views. And I think our story would have been very different as a family if we would have stayed in Uruguay at that time. But we managed to leave, and it's really odd that we ended up in Chicago, because at that time there were two countries that opened their borders up for Uruguayan workers. There was Australia, and it was also the United States, and a lot of the Uduwashas were going to New York. And my dad's brother went to New York, and for some reason, my dad remembered some good friend of his from the neighborhood had gone to Chicago, so he came to Chicago.
Yeah. And then you end up in a neighborhood which is basically all Mexican.
You know, I think, again, because we moved over in this little enclave, which was like an Italian area, it was very different. You know, it was very different back then. And it was like you cross Cermak and then it was very, very Mexicano. But there were like a lot of Mexicanos kind of dispersed here and there. But it was once you cross Cermak and, you know, you got on that side, it was all Mexicano, you know, at that time. Yeah. And it was interesting. You know, my mom started working really early on in the late 70s with Mujeres Latinas en Acción. So we really kind of connected early on with the Latino community here, and especially a lot of the Mexicano community in Chicago.
And that was an organization dedicated to supporting women who were victims of domestic violence.
Yeah, my mom was a prenatal class instructor. So she used to go around to like the schools giving classes to a lot of the young girls who were getting pregnant and was like prenatal, just kind of like classes and support. So she did all sorts of work.
But obviously your family background would have contributed to you feeling somewhat different from a lot of the kids you were growing up with in the neighborhood.
We definitely dealt with our share of experiences that were really sort of negative, negative towards the fact that we spoke Spanish, negative towards the fact that we didn't really know English and we had to learn it. We dealt with stuff that sort of informed and shaped me in a lot of ways and, mm-hmm. and sort of my viewpoints and how I identified, who I identified with, who I saw as somebody I didn't want to be around, you know? Yeah. So
for example, what kind of stuff happened?
I felt like the nuns at the school I went to were really racist. They used me as a translator to tell other kids who spoke Spanish that we could no longer speak Spanish at school, that we weren't allowed to. Then that happened once I developed better English skills, right? There was one kid who kept harassing my brother, and he put a pencil through his hand in class once. Wow. Weird stuff that still leaves questions for me, you know, like, somebody lit our house on fire. We were burned out of the first place we lived in the neighborhood. I don't know the intention behind the torching of the house, but it happened, you know, and we were already dealing with a lot of weird stuff. It's not too far of a stretch to go, was this intentional or not?
That was mainly hostility from what was still predominantly Italian community.
Yeah, it was, you know, and I don't want to just put this blanket around the entire community who was here, because there were some people who were really good to us and nice to us, but I definitely know it was the younger generation of people that there were some conflicts, there were some issues, you right. know? So I think to this day, it lingers that question of like, why did that happen, you know, or who did that, you know?
Well, that's pretty, pretty big stuff to get burnt out of your house.
Yeah, I'm glad I could laugh about it now. I mean, and it's not funny, but it's definitely something that you go, wow, that's really fucked up, you know? Yeah. You grow up wondering, like, why, you mm-hmm. know, why that happened, so.
And so your parents sent you to Catholic school, and and that was that predominantly Italian-American?
I think it was like a mix. There were old Poles, Italian-Americans. Like I said, there were a couple Latinos peppered in. But, you know, you could see the community changing over the years. You know, you got to remember, we got here in 1968, I want to say, 68 or 69. And, you know, there were shifts happening and the community was changing. You know, I remember when I was still in grammar school, they started having Spanish masses. It was like when that didn't exist, you know, 10 years earlier. So you saw that shift occurring.
So then did you always sort of feel naturally aligned and allied with the other Spanish-speaking kids who were, of course, Mexican?
Yeah.
But then was there any way that you were also marked as different as Uruguayan?
Definitely think kids thought like, hey, you say that weird. And, you know, generally when you're really young, kids are just kids. You know, you're all connecting because you can play together. Yeah. I mean, it's like somebody's being nice to you and you can play together. So I don't think it really mattered so much. But you could definitely tell there were differences. I think there were cultural things as well. Like, you know, we ate really late at night. Our friends would be like, we're going to have supper. And it'd be 5 5:30 or something, and we're like, what? And we would just hang out, and we're like, we're gonna go eat dinner later. And they're like, what time do you eat dinner? We're like, we eat around almost 10 o'clock. It was like, we ate late, you know. And I think there were definitely some cultural things that, you know, we had at home that even wasn't gelling with just generally, like, with some people, you know. It was, and I don't mean gelling in a bad way, it just was different.
So as you were growing up, you became more sensitive to various kinds of social issues. You said that was part of what inspired you to kind of get interested in punk, and you know, you felt that you wanted to talk about various things. What were the issues that were kind of prominent in your mind?
I think there were things that definitely stemmed or kind of led to that. My mom had that sort of consciousness, you know. She was just like, well, yeah, you know, all this is happening all over South America. And, you know, you start hearing things about who's behind it, who's backing it, who's funding it. And you hear about, like, the military. And, you know, I know one of my uncles, he had his house raided one night because some neighbor didn't like him. And he called the cops on them, and they raided his house, and they ransacked it, went through looking for anything. And at that time, there's stories of people burying books and records and things because they didn't want to get caught with anything that would imply that they were leftists. So everybody, there was a culture of fear. So I think knowing that that was happening, I mean, when I was in eighth grade, I remember just really disliking Reagan. Mm-hmm. You know, it was almost like natural. Like, I just was like, I don't like this man. And I think, you know, in the household, we were just like, we don't like this man.
As soon as I took office, we attempted to show friendship to the Sandinistas and provided economic aid to Nicaragua. But it did no good. They kept on exporting terrorism. The words of their official party anthem describe us, the United States, as the enemy of all mankind. So much for our sincere but unrealistic hopes that if only we try harder to be friends, Nicaragua would flourish in the glow of our friendship and install liberty and freedom for their people.
Yeah, I remember the beginning of the 80s. One of the slogans that people used on the left was, El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. And, you know, in retrospect, it's remarkable. You know, we were just a few years away from the end of the Vietnam War, and the U.S. was ramping up these counterinsurgency wars by proxy with all of the dictatorships across Latin America.
Yeah, all that stuff sort of sticks around, and I held on to a lot of little bits and pieces, and a lot of the questioning of power, like who has power, who's exerting power, who doesn't have much power, who tries to take power, and all these questions. So I think a lot of that just sort of stuck around with me.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that your mom was known as Socialist Patty, and
that was the nickname they gave her, you know. And I don't know if she was like, she wasn't like, I don't think she adhered to any party or anything like that. You know what I mean? That's not what it was. She definitely was progressive in the way she thought about stuff. Yeah. And I think that, you know, at a certain point that was somewhat dangerous,
right.
You know, so you had to be careful.
But she continued to be involved in kind of neighborhood organizations in Pilsen. What about your dad?
Working class carpenter. He was concerned with working. He, you know, he wasn't like a real political person. I think he maybe over the years later in life became a little more politicized, but that wasn't, you know, he was busy trying to survive, you know, trying to bring money home and make sure things were taken care of for us. So that's what he was really, you know, mm-hmm. My dad, that's his role. That's what he did, you know.
And so was his role in the family relatively kind of subdued in the sense that he was always working and not around? And
I mean, he was around. He worked a lot, but he was definitely around. He wasn't like working all day, all night kind of thing. My dad was much more conservative in a certain sense. He definitely was. I think I really sensed it more as I was getting older and getting into my adolescence. And you really saw, you know, where there would be a shift or something, you know.
What we're going to do right here is go back. Way back. Back into time.
So I know that before you became a punk icon, you actually, at a younger age, were into breakdancing.
Yeah.
So so that might have been maybe one of the first kinds of more overt expressions of you kind of discovering who you were going to be.
Yeah.
And how was that? How was that received in your family?
You know what? I think they thought it was cool. I mean, I think they were excited. You know, it was really weird how it all began. I think I saw it somewhere. I was a part of a crew called the Floor Masters that I was involved with Angelo Prieto. We were the first two around here who were dancing like that. And I think at first people just kind of scratched their head, like, what are they doing? Or what is this? We ran with it. You know, we started this little crew, and next thing you know, we had like dancers from all over the city that were dancing with us and other kids who were coming together. It was cool. I think my family were like, oh, Martin's doing his thing. He's dancing. But you know, then all of a sudden we're coming out on the Phil Donahue show.
It's my pleasure to present from Chicago, and yes, New York, you're represented here, so be patient. We'll get to you in just a moment. Please welcome the Floor Masters. Where'd you see them? Come on, y'all.
You know, it's like it went, you know, it was this, like, again, a very neighborhood thing. And, you know, next thing you know, we're like, you know, I was in a Mr. T movie, like dancing, like just it was weird, you know, it was really strange. Wow. But I think the most amazing thing of that era was 1983 when I started dancing. It was the first time that I could go to all these different neighborhoods and not get my ass kicked.
Right.
All of a sudden, the lines that were so hardcore between these neighborhoods and communities, it was like they blurred for a while because everyone was like, oh, that's a dancer, that's a b-boy. And I think, you know, I didn't see that happen again until like punk, right? And all of a sudden it was like, oh, you're a rocker. I think these alternative sort of things and lifestyles really kind of gave one certain amount of freedom and access to sort of move around a little more freely in the city and not have to worry too much about these problems, right? Or like getting jumped. They didn't disappear. It just made it a little easier.
Right. So you actually were able to escape, in a way, the known categories by occupying some new category. It really shows how important the arts and culture are, you know, as a basis for liberating yourself from those narrow, scripted roles that are the only thing that seem to be available.
Yes, yes. I mean, you were basically breaking the mold when you did something different. You know, there were certain roles young people are expected to take, you know, or certain paths. And when you go off that path, really wonderful things can happen for somebody. When you start seeing and doing things that are really different, it kind of sets you a little bit apart. It kind of gives you a little bit of a pass to not have to deal with some of the bullshit.
Right. Chicago is a city that's notoriously segregated. Mm-hmm. Different neighborhoods, as you said, you know, very clearly and distinctly separated and demarcated. And of course, that translates also into the sense of different gangs and different neighborhoods. If you're associated with one place, you kind of are presumed to be affiliated. So this really kind of gave you a way to sort of step out of that. Were you aware of that at the time? I mean, were you thinking about like a pressure on you to be involved in the local gang?
That was always there. You know, at one point, you know, my parents thought like I was hanging out too much in the neighborhood, and my dad was a strong fucking dude, and he just put an end to it. I mean, there was at one point they were considering moving me back to Uruguay to live in South America. So my dad just was like, you're not leaving the house for shit. It's like, you go to school, you come home, and it's over. And I think there was even this part of me that's like, I better find something new to do because this is going to get boring really fast. So I think the 80s were a really unique time. A lot of really cool scenes were popping up, you know, creative stuff that was popping up. And I was just like, I need to get into some of this. I want a part of that. So
it's interesting, too, because the stereotype about the 80s is that it was, you know, it was very mediocre culturally. Right.
I disagree.
And, you know, I mean, Yeah, no, you were tapping into a lot of things, you know, undercurrents, subterranean kinds of cultural movements.
Yes, underground culture, yeah.
And, you know, but of course that was the era where, you know, as you say, it was the Reagan era. There was a certain kind of new boldness about conservatism. There was, a certain kind of uninhibited celebration of money making. The whole yuppie culture. So there was that kind of element.
Well, right. And there was everything that opposed it, right?
Right.
And that's where I was. Yeah. That's where I was culturally, mentally, physically, was in these, like you said, subterranean underground culture. And Chicago had a very rich culture, like in the 80s. I mean, we had in the communities these young queer kids who were dancing, like the Culitos, the Imported Taste, all these dance crews that were popping up like all over the city. And it was fascinating. It was fascinating on so many levels. And, you know, I remember, you know, Culitos would roll through all the neighborhoods and recruit young queer kids. They would clock queer kids and be like, you're going to hang out with us. Wow. And, you know, it was just kind of like this whole thing was happening. If you didn't want that, if you wanted something harder, you got into punk. And it was just like, so there was a lot of really cool underground stuff. And I think Chicago, you know, and just if this is my opinion, I think it's lost its sense of identity over the years. It had a real strong cultural thing happening way back. And I feel like, you know, everybody looks to the coast as the creators of culture, but we had our own thing brewing here. And I think like a lot of people have lost it a bit,
yeah.
You know?
So did you know that you were one of those queer kids at the time, or did you sort of discover it in the course of that?
No, it was something I came into later on. It was when I was really young, you know, I remember Angelo taking me to North Avenue Beach and all the Culitos were hanging out there. And I remember they were like, oh, hey, you know, what's your name? And I was kind of really nervous and I was really young and they were complimenting. They asked me if I was a soccer player because I had really nice big calves. And I remember just being like, what? But they were really nice and it was really cool. But I definitely was not in tune to sexuality at all. I was kind of really asexual and really kind of scared of it. It wasn't until later on in life that I really came to terms with my, you know, sexual or, my identity and mm-hmm. who I was as a man or that I loved men. So that took some time.
Yeah. So how did that play out in terms of, you know, your relationship to punk? Kind of was, you know, was your music a kind of way to sort of express some of that?
Definitely there was an awareness of queers that were punk, right? And I, you know, I came from like, you know, from the 80s into the 90s in punk, and it was a very aggressive scene. So it wasn't a place that I would have ever viewed as what people call a safe space for queer people. I think, you know, the Chicago scene, it had a lot of skinheads in it. There were a lot of, it just had a very aggressive edge, and I understand why that existed. You know, I remember seeing one guy at a show that looks, you know, he definitely had sort of queer visibility. Like he was queer, you know, and people knew him, but I was just like, oh, I wonder if someone's going to mess with him. Because I also was living over here, and you saw when there were young queer kids around, like kids who couldn't hide it if they tried, you know what I mean? They were just like, effeminate boys got fucked with all the time and they got picked on all the time. So I was in this scene that already had a very just aggressiveness to it. I thought, oh no, these that dude's gonna get messed with. It took time for me to sort of build up the strength and the courage in punk, you know, even with Grudos. You know, I was in Grudos when I came out of the closet, and that was like, you know, there was things that I was afraid of to a certain sense, you know, to a certain degree. I thought, oh, it's like, all of a sudden people gonna dislike the band or just feel really weird. But then I was also coming into my own skin and just going, you know what? I don't give a shit, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, in part, like, you know, why I think, you know, we titled that one record Canciones para liberar nuestras fronteras, you know, songs to liberate our borders. It was like, it wasn't, you know, the border not being just a physical border, but a mental border. There's songs on that and lyrics and on that record that definitely talk about, you know, my queerness, mm-hmm. and being gay, you know. So, and then, you know, the familial stuff is also really, it's a tough one. Like, coming out is never easy, and especially then it wasn't easy, you know. And I didn't even come out, you know, I kind of got yanked out. My mom noticed that I was hanging out with the gay dude from down the street, and she started warning me, saying, hey, you know, people are noticing, I don't know if you want to deal with that. And I was just like, Ma, leave me alone, you know. And it kind of was this back and forth, and then finally, you know, after she had asked me several times and was super stressed out, do I have something going on with this guy, I finally said, yeah, I do. Well, I do have something going on with it. It definitely came with its share of rechazo, you know, like just kind of backlash. Yeah. And I wasn't embraced for it or accepted for it. But, you know, at that point in my life, I think I had built enough of a thick skin and really had a stronger sense of who I was that I felt like, okay, you know what? I was still living in the nest. It's time to go, mm-hmm. you know? And that's kind of where, you know, a lot of shifting happened for me in mm-hmm. my life. So,
and what about your father? How did he react?
You know, surprisingly, I think my dad had a harder time with the punk thing than he did with finding out that I was gay. You know, my dad, I think he thought punk was gay, which, you know, in some aspects it is, but it was early on when I had like my mohawk and I would wear ripped up clothes. I would have trouble with my dad. My dad did not like, I remember once he told me we had to go somewhere together and he goes, "Vos vas a cruzar la calle, no caminas conmigo." He's like, "You're crossing the street. We're not walking together. I don't want to be seen with you." And which is like, you know, for some, you know, at the time I was like, okay, cool. You know, but, you know, and I could see for some younger kid that really being like devastating to, you know, be told by a parent that I don't want to walk with you.
I don't be seen with you. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to be seen with you. I remember I came home from a show once and I had this ripped up shirt. And my jeans had holes all over them. And my combat boots on, and I just remember he must have been in a mood because he came in and he was like, "En esta casa no se viste así." Like, he was just like, "You don't dress like that in this house. We wear decent clothes in this house." And I said, "Well, I like this." He goes, "Oh, you like it?" And he came over and like tore my shirt. God. It was like he ripped it to the point where it's like, I think, hanging off one little piece, and grabbed my pant and like tore like a leg off pretty much. And I, you know, I, of course, being the fucking rebellious teenager or whatever I was, I said, "Me gusta más todavía." Like, I like it even more. Which is hilarious now that I think about it. It's like, what a little asshole, you know, that I was. But it was my response. And then, you know, I would get into these things like, is it really like that big of a deal? You know, but we kind of stopped communicating for a long time. I mean, it wasn't cute. It wasn't fun. I can laugh at it now. I'm in my 50s. But at the time, yeah, it was hard. It was weird. You know, it was different, you know. And when I came out and the family found out, that was the first time I truly felt I wasn't welcome in my own home. Mm. And that's why I knew inside it was time for me to go, mm-hmm. you know, and that was healthy. And it wasn't only healthy for me. It was healthy for, I think, members of the family, because they needed to figure it out. They needed to, you know, I have a very strong bond with my family now. It's amazing. They needed time.
Yeah.
They needed time.
How old were you then?
When I left, it I mean, it was a little late. I want to say I was 25.
Right.
Yeah, I want to say 25. We never had the expectation of you leave the house when you're 18, 19. You left if you got married kind of thing, which is pretty common in a lot of Latino households, you know?
Yeah.
But it was around 25, 26, and everything started changing, you know? And it was like time for me to go.
So you moved out of the house, but you were still located here in the Mexican community in Pilsen. Let's talk about some of the songs. Let's talk about the lyrics. I'm reminded, for example, of your song, No Me Vengan a Salvar.
No Me Vengan a Salvar, you know, don't come and save us, was because, you know, during that early Crudos era, there were people around who were trying to really sort of influence us or try to, like, get us to do certain things or think certain ways. You should be a part of this party or this group. And we were just like, fuck it all. We want new. And, you know, and it says, yo quiero algo, algo nuevo, algo más puro. I want, you know, something new. I want something pure. I want something fresh. It says, no me vengan a salvar. Don't come in our communities trying to save us. Like, we don't have the capacity with our own brains and creative power and energy to make change for ourselves. And I just, it was very frustrating.
So those were really left radical groups coming and trying to recruit you to their politics. And that's really to say it was the white left, and they felt probably like they were coming like missionaries or something.
Yeah, it was left groups, you know, where people felt like you guys are like anarchists. They assumed certain things about all of us, and there was never an ideology that was singular with our band. We weren't about one thing. We were into observing and learning about as much as we could. We already came from a history of people wanting you to join shit, right? It was like, why do I have to pick a party, you know? And you know, there were definitely some people who would come into the neighborhood who weren't from the neighborhood and, you know, would try to recruit young people. And it was like, we don't need anyone coming here to save us. Like, we'll save ourselves.
So it felt like they had the gospel and they needed to come and enlighten you or something.
Hell yeah. I think that's what they felt or thought. And we were just like, no. We were really about trying to come up with solutions that were unique to our experiences. Our politic was unique. I think a lot of the books that have been written about certain political ideologies are talking about a different context, a different time. I think there's definitely things that you can cross over and relate, but I also feel like when you're talking about young people growing up in communities like this, their experiences are also very different. There's things that are very unique to those places. So I thought we always had to come up with something new, you know?
Let me go back to the punk scene. Chicago was the hotbed of neo-Nazi skinhead and became a kind of incubator for that scene nationally, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the time where you had, you know, Nazi punks and you had, you know, anti-Nazi skinheads and do you have any kind of memories or examples of some of that?
Of course. I mean, there were situations where I remember two carloads of us went to go see some bands from, you know, the UK, from England, who'd come over. And we saw them here in Chicago, but then we got in cars and drove to Milwaukee to go see them play there, since it was only like an hour and 15 minutes away. And like, we basically got jumped by these Nazis over there. I mean, there were some situations where there were, like, massive brawls that would break out over this, like, you know, ideology. And, you know, it was very counterpunk. From Pilsen, we're going out to the Metro or to the Cubby Bear or wherever. We would be a pack of 20. Nobody wanted to fuck with us. We'd get on the train and it was almost frightening. Like, the people were like, who are all these brown kids? They're on the train all at once and the whole train would get quiet because people were scared. But we weren't there to hurt anyone.
Right.
We want to go see bands play. But then you go to a show and then you're like, you know, stuff might go down. You didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, because you were traveling from the south side to the north side. You were
right.
You were Latinos.
Right.
And, yeah. You know, going to neighborhoods where, you know, Latinos didn't live for the most part.
Yeah.
So. How do you feel like it plays in the punk scene? The punk scene created a space where there could be that element and it could express itself, could manifest itself.
Right. Well, it's not a private club. It doesn't have a singular ideology. It belongs to everybody or anybody who wants it. So you could have some weird faction develop or somebody who just has crazy influence on people. Somebody would get into punk. They might say something that was questionable or messed up. And it was like, fuck you. You said something fucked up. You're racist. You're fascist. Get out of here. So then what happens to that person who came into the scene thinking they were going to get accepted for being a weirdo or whatever, all of a sudden got the boot. So who's going to become their new pack of friends?
Yeah.
These fascist groups that were like, we'll be your friend. We don't care that you said something stupid.
Right.
Come on over here. You're going to be a part of us now. And it's, it, you know, becomes that kind of gang mentality again.
Yeah. Where because someone felt different, because they felt alienated, they found some place to go only then to get rejected again.
Yeah. They're looking for a community. So it's complicated. It's very complicated.
Well, of course, punk is associated with anger and alienation. And there were plenty of those feelings in your own experience, I'd imagine. But I wanted to come back to this sort of more personal dimension of, you know, the expressive and creative process. You were sitting and writing these lyrics, you know, sort of translating some of what you were feeling into a form that could touch, you know, other young people, what they were feeling. So let's talk a little bit about that process of you sitting there and thinking about songwriting, coming up with lyrics.
You're right. There, in terms of the feelings of, you know, anger and frustration or, you know, alienation, and that definitely is a factor. But I think, you know, when it came to the writing and the thinking about, you know, we were really reaching out. We were like, we want to write stuff that is going to make a connection with other people in our community. We weren't going to write songs about, like, I'm mad at mom and dad or I hate mom and dad. It, you know, it's like, it was a little different. There's punk that communicates to certain audiences and has certain angles on what they write about. I think when I wrote lyrics, I thought about maybe these collective experiences that other people were going to relate to. That was sort of the angle.
Right. Well, there's a sensibility in your lyrics, in almost all of your songs, that reminds me of the whole tradition of protest music in Latin America.
Yeah. You know, somebody I remember years ago told me, they're like, my grandfather read your lyrics and loves them, hates the music, but loves your lyrics. I just thought that was hilarious. Somebody saying that somebody was not into that kind of music at all could really appreciate and get behind what the song was about. Yeah. And what it was saying. So there were points that I felt that our songs, once they left us, were no longer ours. Sure, we wrote them and rewrote those lyrics, but I also felt they became a part of the people. Yeah. And, you know, there was a point that I just got really, I just felt like it was a lot to carry. And, you know, for me, I think that's when the band kind of came to a close. It felt like the collectivity of the band and the creativeness around that collective energy and thinking, and it kind of stopped. And when I started feeling like I was the only one sort of carrying it, I felt it was a good time to stop. Members of the band didn't want to, but I felt like, what are we doing then? Are we just, you know, participating in this cycle of sort of rock and roll culture where we just tour and travel? And I always said Gurulos was never just a band.
Never just a band. So what was it?
It became something that went beyond the medium. Mm-hmm. We could have been the type of band that just followed suit. And, you know, that even sounds funny coming from punk, right? But there's a lot of punk rockers who follow suit. They play the same places. They play the punk venue. They go to other cities and only play the punk venue. And what were we doing? We were playing Cabaret Rojo. with a drag queen at Calles y Sueños. Carulas was performing with folk singers. We were performing exhibits where there were artists, and we would perform with punk bands too. We performed with everybody. Yeah. And I think that's what the unique thing about Carulas was. We weren't sticking to a template. We were kind of doing our own thing, and that's what made it different than anything else.
Right? You mentioned Calles y Sueños, which was a cultural center here in Chicago that both of us were connected to, and you lived upstairs from it. Mm-hmm. I have a very vivid memory of one of your concerts there. You guys even practiced in the basement of Calles y Sueños then.
Yeah.
But I have a memory of one of your concerts there that ended up basically out on the street and that, you know, kind of shut down the street in, you know, an impromptu outdoor concert. And then,
we've had some really cool shows that went beyond just being a regular, you know, punk show, right?
Yeah. But it speaks to what you're describing is it became part of the culture and it was related to other things that were happening culturally in the neighborhood, you know, or in Latino Chicago more generally. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for example, when you did the retrospective exhibit a couple of years ago about Latino punk in Chicago in that era, for which Los Crudos was, you know, central, you know, a key element and a formative element. You know, you also were kind of making a nod to the other artistic and cultural things that were happening in the community around you that kind of created an environment that made it possible for you to kind of experiment and innovate in the ways that you did, right?
You know, it wasn't out of the ordinary for Carulas to play in the neighborhood and you're like, and there's all these different artists who are here. I think there was respect to, you know, to what we were doing. It was bringing some new life into, you know, an already existing art thing that was happening in the community. And we were just another element of it. So,
and as you say, even with people who might not have really liked the music, But it nonetheless kind of crossed, you know, built bridges and it crossed certain lines, you know.
Absolutely.
Which goes back to the earlier point you were making about the fact that you were breaking down boundaries. You were breaking out of boundaries.
Yeah.
Borders that kind of defined even your relationship to, you know, where you grew up. Suddenly you were kind of creating new ways for people to take hold of a certain freedom of movement.
Yeah, it was really intentional the way we sort of went about things. I remember some kid coming up to me on 18th Street and said he wanted me to sign something for him. And this is during the Carulas era. And I was like, you want me to? And we were like, what? Like, we were punking that way. We were like, we don't want to autograph anything. That just felt really awkward to us. But I do remember he said, I want you to sign this because you guys are going to become famous. And, you know, I'm not going to be able to see you guys again like this. And I just thought, that's not what we want. That's not who we are. So I was like, no, man, you know, we're going to be around. That wasn't where we wanted to place ourselves as a band. And I know some people scratch their heads around that. Like, why didn't you do that? That was an opportunity, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, we had other opportunities that we preferred to take.
Yeah, I mean, and you guys ended up touring around the world. You traveled, I think, to Japan, across Europe, across Latin America.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember we played a show. We were playing at the Fireside Bowl, and I remember
Chicago Bowling Alley.
Yeah, Chicago Bowling Alley, for those who don't know. The oddest thing happened, these suits. And when I say suits, I mean these men and women. They came to the Carulas show, and they were all Latino, and they came to have a conversation with us about an opportunity. And I said, Jose, I'm not talking to these fucking people. I said, you deal with this shit. They have no business even being here. I don't know why they're here. And Jose just went up. It's like, no, 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 vengan con tus chingaderas. Get the fuck out of here. We don't want you here. We don't care what you want with us. We're not interested. Right. And it was just our total, like, DIY punk ethos coming out. Like, no. You know, we don't want to hear how you want to figure out a way to make money off us. We just weren't interested.
So part of it, you know, was always that idea that someone was going to come along and try to turn you into a commodity.
They wanted that. There were people who definitely wanted that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you guys had a very conscious, explicit sense like, no, we're not selling out. We're going to, you know, not go that.
Yeah.
Not go that way. So, I mean, this speaks to a bigger theme, which is, you know, that all of this, you know, Los Crudos and punk music, but also talking about breakdancing when you were younger, you know, are part of your development as an artist, your quest for a way to express yourself and communicate as an artist creatively. And, you know, and then you went on to do photography, for example. And, I wanted to ask you to sort of speak to that bigger issue, right? Yeah. Which is rather than sort of reducing you to one piece of your story, to kind of ask you to sort of reflect on the larger whole, you know?
I think what happened for me in this sort of journey as an artist and trying to figure out, like, you know, you have to keep in mind, I went to an all boys Catholic high school where what was worshiped was sport. It wasn't art. It wasn't creativity. There were a tremendous amount of rules. I was really struggling because I was in this world that I was not connecting with. I remember taking the one, only one art class that existed at that school. And it was like, you know, the brother or priest or whoever it was wanted us to paint these trees. And me and my friends, we were clowning all the time because it just wasn't challenging. It was like, paint and draw what you see and only what you see. I was like, I want something else. There's something else out there for me. So right out of high school, I ended up going to Columbia College and I got myself in the photography department there. And I had a really tough time in high school. My first report card is like 3 F's, 2 D's, and a C. Okay. I sucked as a student. I remember literally being told like shit, like, you know, being called a loser, being made fun of. And I was like, man, fuck this place. Fuck all these people. Like, I know there was something else for me. And it just wasn't what was in front of me at that time. But I do remember once I got in sort of Columbia and started really experiencing this whole other thing, and my world started opening up. So I think there was like a huge level of learning and a huge level of unlearning. And I had to sort of retrain my brain to think about the world a little differently because I was being exposed to so much more. I really immersed myself in art. And this is before Los Crudos. I would go to lectures, whether it was like Dwayne Michaels or Ann Noggle or Nan Golden. Like, I was just seeing all this great work. I love documentary photography. And there were certain artists who really moved me. Robert Frank's The Americans, the book really depicted an era and time of American society. And the one thing I didn't like about my experience as a photographer was that there were a whole new set of really stringent rules, like your negative is precious and everything had to be sterile and archival. And there's a certain thing about that that's good, but I think I needed something more explosive and dirtier. Coming from Catholic high school, all boys Catholic high school, I think I needed something else. And I was trying to break out of all these sort of layers and barriers to get to that point where I could be a little messier.
So then documentary photography was appealing to you in part because it allowed you to kind of connect with the messiness and the dirtiness of real life.
I think so. And over time, I realized like I was building this archive of work, you know, of people and times and, you know, events. And I ended up with a pretty tremendous archive of photographs, yeah. You know?
Yeah, but of course, I mean, and it is that, absolutely. I mean, it's an archive of time and a place, or many times and many places. But obviously, it's not just about recording what's there, because you're composing something, and you have a vision and an angle of vision that's unique. So I'm wondering how you thought about that, even, for example, in your photography of the punk scene, because you're both immersed in it, and you're part of it, but you're also, with the photography, creating a distance between yourself and it, right?
You don't have time to compose when there's a band playing at, you know, 300 beats per minute or whatever, or more. You're just like, holy crap, you know, and it's like you're getting pushed and people are dancing. It's wild. There's not a lot of room for you having much control under those situations. But when, you know, the music stopped is when I was able to make these connections with people and actually do a portrait of somebody. And that's where I felt, you know, where that sort of, like we say, control was happening. Because in a punk show, it's out of control. There's no control. You know, you're getting kicked in the head and it's just like your camera, you know, gets knocked right. down. I mean, there's yeah, that happened all the time.
People flying through the air.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing, of course, is that you've continued to make music, and not only punk music. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell me a little bit about your current musical projects?
You know, I'm still doing punk music, but I also, you know, we're not singular human beings. Like, we have all sorts of experience, and people may think, oh, he's just into punk. It's like, no, I'm not just into punk. I didn't grow up being into only punk. Now, do I love punk? Hell yes, I do. And I know a lot about it, and I love, you know, being in bands that play punk. But, you know, when I think about all the music I was exposed to as a kid and growing up, I mean, you can't be from Chicago and not be exposed to house music, right? You can't, or like really early new wave, or, you know, there's just all these different genres of music. And even predating that, like what we listened to at home as kids, you know, I mean, I grew up on Alfredo Zitarrosa.
Los zapatos aquellos que tuve y anduve con ellos. ¿Dónde estará mi cuchillo y mi honda? El muchacho que fui, que responda.
All the real, like, politicized folk stuff that was coming out of South America, particularly Uruguay, whether it was Daniel Viglietti, Los Olimareños, like I said, Alfredo Zitarrosa, like, all this was really important, right? Well, the same thing with, like, you know, the 80s and stuff. You had amazing house music that, I mean, it really became embedded in the fabric of what is Chicago. I loved that stuff. And so I started a project called Nerve, and it's NRRRV. And I released two tracks not that long ago. And it was a really huge step for me because people are always trying to box you in. Oh, you're this person from that, and this is what we know you for, and this is what you do. People generally want to keep people slotted. And I think as an artist, this is one of the things that all artists struggle with, is like feeling that you can just go where you feel you need to go. I've learned over the years to not, you know, let the medium define who I am as a person or as an artist. Rather, I pick and pull and throw out or absorb whatever medium to communicate what I want to communicate.
All right. Well, let's listen to a clip from your new project, Nerve. This track is called The Gaze. Cool. and so different from your punk music.
And it was a little scary to do it. You know, you kind of go, whoa, this is really different for me. And I don't know what the reaction's going to be, but I really love it. So I'm going to put it out there. And, you know, if only two people respond positively to it, then cool. I don't care.
And, you know, you were very, very rooted in the Chicago scene. You talked about how at a certain point it felt like, you know, the Crudos project had become, you know, a little bit of a burden. Then you went to California for a long time. Mm-hmm. So you lived in California in the Bay Area for I don't know how many years.
Yeah. So what happened was, you know, I was working on the documentary that I was doing for my master's, you know, thesis. And that project was Más Allá de los Gritos, Beyond the Screams. And it was a documentary on the Latino punk scene in the United States. I went to L.A., which also has a massive Latino punk scene. So I went there to do some videotaping and all that. Well, I ended up meeting somebody when I was on that trip. I came back, I finished up my schooling and everything, but I started this relationship with somebody and it led me to Santa Ana, California. I lived behind the Orange Curtain, what they call it, because it's Orange County, California, but it's a very Mexicano part of Orange County. There was this whole new community that I was connecting to, and there were all these drag queens I was hanging out with. There were all these, you know, people from the Mexican Cultural Center in Santa Ana, and we started doing all these collaborations, and I was bringing punk bands in from Japan and France. And then that relationship changed, and I had an opportunity to go to San Francisco, and I spent, I want to say, about 12 years in San Francisco. I was living in the Bay Area and got involved with Maximum Rock and Roll fanzine and radio, and I was, you know, I got my teaching credential there. I became a high school teacher. There were a lot of shifts and changes. And the one thing that was amazing was almost everywhere I went, I really connected with a community that was artistic, that was creative, that I was connecting with culturally, you know, linguistically. And, you know, it wasn't until I went to San Francisco that I felt that I was losing that. When my time was up in San Francisco, I came back to Chicago and I came back to the neighborhood and I started reconnecting with people. There's a lot of things I hate about Chicago, like I hate about a lot of cities, but there's definitely people that I've always had a really nice connection with.
Well, and you came back to a changed neighborhood. In the last 20 years, the Pilsen population overall has, you know, been depleted by 15,000 to 20,000 people. And that was almost entirely the displacement of the poorest part of the Latino population in Pilsen. In 2018, Forbes magazine even said that Pilsen was one of the coolest neighborhoods in the world. In the world, can you imagine? So let's talk about gentrification.
Gentrification, what can I tell you? It's, you know, if you're going to gentrify property, gentrify everything. Gentrify our poverty. Gentrify our fucking addictions. Gentrify all the issues that come with a place. You want to throw money at something? Throw it everywhere. Gentrification has been happening. It's going to happen. People have gotten into this thing of like, oh, it's just what occurs. No, it is intentional. That is not an accident. People are strategizing. It's like one of our biggest complaints ever when Cruz was like, the city ignored our asses forever. Pilsen was a fucking disaster. It was like so run down. There were no resources. Nothing was coming through. No money was being thrown at this part of the city, you know? And it's just like, what a slap in the face. You know, we've talked to death about these issues, you know, it's like, but in the end of the day, you know what? It happens. People get displaced. It's economic. It's a lot of things, you know, people think it's just racial. It's not just racial. It's a lot of stuff going on there. But, you know, like I said, in the end of the day, you can move me wherever or you can move whoever, we don't cease to exist. Okay, so it's like when, you know, black and brown families are moved around in like a new future community that doesn't include us always, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. People are not disappearing. They're just being displaced, but they're going to reappear someplace else, inevitably. you came back and made yourself visible. You organized an exhibit, a retrospective on Latino punk in Chicago during the 90s, where you yourself were a central figure, but also a collector, right? You collected the memorabilia and all of the sort of, all the sort of different paraphernalia of that moment in time and that particular cultural scene. And part of what really was impressive for me about that show was that even though it was centrally about the music, you actually put on display the fact that it was about so much more. The posters and the flyers and, you know, the sort of artwork that, that went into t-shirts and, cassette cases and record sleeves and, and just this whole explosive kind of creative moment that created so many outlets for so many people to find a way to express themselves. And, I feel like, that's part of what you're talking about, even in your own experience. Each genre, each medium, each particular technique is just incidental in a sense to the fact that there's something more fundamental about, what you're striving to do.
I think a lot of the archiving that I do is really, when I did the video, the documentary was like, who's ever going to tell this story if I don't tell it? That was sort of a job of mine, was to get into that and share this with the world. There's some cities, and I think New York, LA, of course, they blow their shit up all the time. They're always about their artists, their musicians, their cultural creators. And we have cultural creators here all the time. But, even when Crudo started, there were a lot of people who were like, what are you doing? What is this? And it wasn't until people in other places started going, hey, you have this band over there. I don't know if you know about them. And people were going, oh, yeah, they're awesome. They're great. It's like they almost needed like an outside approval. People don't worship the stuff that comes from here. I want kids who are making stuff right now, the kids who are being creative, blow your shit up, support each other. Like, this is what that's about. Don't wait for somebody else to come and say, oh yeah, at this point I think it's valid. It's like, no, just make it happen. You have an idea, execute it, get out and do it. I always say this as a comparison, like come New Year's, right? Everybody turns on the TV. You see California has their singers and their performers perform. New York's got their artists performing. And then you go to Chicago and you're like, where the hell are the house DJs? Why isn't there this massive house party being televised with all the local DJs and artists performing? You might get a blues band, but the party's dead. It just seems dead. And I'm like, man, Chicago has so much to offer, and we keep cheating ourselves. And it's so annoying. My archiving is basically going, this happened. This really happened. This was amazing. I'm waiting to see if somebody's going to do a documentary on Los Culitos. It would be amazing. Young, flamboyant, out queen, dancing together, like doing routines at Janelle's or wherever. Janelle's was a night, club here in Chicago. It was like, there was this stuff that was happening right out of the streets. It was organic. It was super new. I'm not going to wait for some academic who's going to Columbus our shit, just say, oh, I discovered this. No, you didn't discover us. We were there. We did it.
Get out there. Do it.
Yeah. Sorry. I know that was a little bit of a tirade, but that's just whatever.
That's a great place for us to wrap up. Thank you, Martin.
No, thank you. Have a good one. I appreciate it.
Please remember to subscribe and share the podcast with a friend. Thanks for listening, and take good care of yourself.
Metropolis Rising is produced and edited by Magdalena Rodriguez. The intro and outro music for the podcast is produced by Cole DeGenova and is from his album, Really Human. To To listen to more of Cole's music, visit coledegenova.com. And lastly, a special thanks to our little friend Akali.
Make sure you're born at the right time. Right sun and moon sign with the right genes. Right belly with means in the right place. Backyard, plenty space. Right smile, sitting on the right face. Right skin tone, right gender, right features. Gotta have a real good preschool teacher. And always eat the right food. So you be in the right mood and the right minds. So the right folks like you be in the right crowd. Right classes, right groups. Get the right grades, right majors. Right schools, gotta always do the right thing. Righteous, maybe the right one. Have 2.5 kids. Get the right job with the right boss. Put your money in the right bank, in the right stocks. And when you wake up and something seem wrong, then you better find the right one to put the blame on. Yeah.
Have it your own mind to make your own God, your own love, your own faith. All you have is your own will to create your own God, your own love, your own faith. All you have is your own mind to make your own God, your own love, your own faith. All you have is your own will to create.
It doesn't make any difference whether you can't love a woman, can't love a man, can't love anybody. You're dangerous. Because you have no way of learning humility. No way of learning that other people suffer. And no way of learning how to use your suffering and theirs to get from one place to another.